going through this series, talking all about the life of David, and we're going to spend some time looking at Saul's last moments of life together this morning. And death is not a fun subject to talk about a lot of times. Woody Allen captures it so well. He says, "It's not that I'm afraid to die. I just don't want to be there when it happens." And I think that's a sentiment that a whole lot of people would share. About a year and a half ago, here in the auditorium, we did a memorial for someone who was a longtime member of our church, but also just an outstanding man in our community, Bob Andrews. And it was really, any of you that were here for it know what an amazing memorial it was, and a celebration of a truly outstanding man who was a good husband and a good dad and just met and served so many people so well. And one of the things that was really neat about it is there were people both from this church that really saw Jesus living in and through Bob that got to come up and share about how they saw Jesus alive in his life. And it was, you know, it was an exemplary testimony to so many of us of what it means to live well. But, you know, there are also a lot of people that were not, they weren't Christians and weren't necessarily a part of this church, that also just recognized so many of the character traits that Bob embodied that we read in the Bible so well. And we had a good time laughing and sharing and celebrating. And so it didn't really matter if you were a Jesus follower, part of this church, or you just knew Bob from, you know, professionally or through his work that he did in the community. Everybody recognized that he was an outstanding man of character and work. And it was really fun to talk about the good, you know, the gift that he was to so many of us. One of the things I thought about, and I've thought about often, I was talking with Dan about that memorial here this morning, and Dan, as he was thinking about it, brought tears to his eyes. One of the things I was thinking about is there are moments like that where we get a glimpse into a reminder of what it looks like to live well. And Bob really did live well. And it has served over the last year and a half for me moments of pause in my own life to think about, you know, when I'm gone, when they have a memorial for me, and I hope one or two of you will show up for that before you have potato salad in the back or whatever, I hope that I will be remembered well for the way I lived. One of the things that was so neat about Bob is that his testimony wasn't just purely about him, but he represented God so well in his commitment to him. And it spoke well not only of Bob, but also he won a good name for other people as they think about the God that Bob serves. Well, today we're going to spend some time talking about Saul, who is sort of a little bit different than that. Saul probably did not have very many of the good things said about him at his memorial that other people had said about Bob and other folks that we know that represented God so well. But here's the thing. Whether it was Bob's memorial or Saul's memorial, I think that there's so much we can learn about life and what it means to honor God from watching and seeing the choices that other people made. And that's one of the things that you're going to notice today as we talk about Saul's life is, although the man, he failed in a lot of respects and he lived a dismal life through and suffered a lot of the dismal consequences of poor choices, I think he presents an outstanding opportunity for us to look and learn, look inwards at our own life and the choices we make, and also think about what it means to live an exemplary life. His life is marked, the final days of his life are marked at the very end of the book of Samuel. And I want to walk through just a couple of these verses with you to give you an idea of how he meets his end. Now, it tells us that Saul was fighting against the Philistines. And as the men that were with him were fighting, they fled up to Mount Gilboa, which is way up north of where Israel is today. Mount Gilboa is still there. Now, one of the things that's interesting here is there's a contrast that's going on right away as soon as you start reading this. David is fighting the Amorites in the south and is achieving a great victory with God at his side, helping him as he tracks down and fights the Amorites. And the flip side of this is Saul is about to meet his demise on Mount Gilboa. On that day, Saul died together with three of his four sons and his armor bearer. And it's interesting that it mentions his armor bearer was there and died with him. Who was Saul's first armor bearer that we were introduced to? Yeah, David. And David is not there fighting with Saul at his end. And there's a good reason for that, obviously, that we'll talk about. So as the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities. They take They tuck tail and they run. They are out of there. The Philistines come and camp and live, take over those cities for themselves. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons dead on Gilboa. So they cut off Saul's head and his son's head, spoils of victory, and they take and put their bodies up in the temples of their gods. And this is obviously good news to all of the Philistines. Now, fortunately, there are some men from this town called Jabesh-Gilead, and they hear what the Philistines have done. And so they, several of them, journey through the night, go into where Saul and his sons have been put up on the walls, nailed up on the walls, and they collect their bodies and bring them home and give them proper burial. Not a good end, a tragic end for Saul. Saul is hurt so bad at the end. He knows he's going to die, and he knows that the Philistines are going to come and dismember him. It's not going to be a pretty end for him, and he doesn't want to be alive when he's captured, even though he's already mortally wounded. So he asks his armor bearer to finish him off, and his armor bearer says, "No way am I doing that." And you understand why. The armor bearer, had he survived and it was found out that he killed Saul, it would not have gone so well for him. So the armor bearer does not want to kill Saul. So Saul ultimately, he's so scared of the Philistines that he takes his own sword and he falls on it to kill himself, which there are very few suicides captured in the Bible. And the reason for that is there was a great deal of fear in Judaism at the time that if you committed suicide, that dying that way would exempt you from eternal life with God. So it was a big no-no. It was a big taboo to them. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. So Saul's willingness to fall on his own sword here in the Bible to capture it is a big deal. But that is that's the end and the demise of Saul. I want to look at how did Saul get in this predicament and how did he meet this end. And so to understand this, we're going to walk back through Saul's downfall, because it wasn't just one moment, and it didn't just happen all at once. It was a steady progression of poor choices that Saul makes all along the way. And it's a very tragic story, and I want to march back through it. The first thing I want to do is just pause before we get to some of the mistakes that Saul makes and say, you know what? He did get off to an outstanding start. There is a town that is kind of out by itself, that is away from the main area where most of the people in Israel lived, and it's Jabesh-Gilead. And they're right next to the Amorites, and the Amorites have a king named Nahash, and he comes and subjects those people to a pretty brutal, you know, subjugation to make them their slaves. Saul and the people of Israel find out about this, and Saul gets together 65,000 men, and he marches out into the wilderness away from, you know, not even a strategic place, a very small community, and he rescues these people from Nahash and the Amorites. And the people there in Jabesh-Gilead are forever thankful that though they're kind of out there by themselves, Saul didn't forget them. And in fact, remember the end of the story, how there were some brave people that came to rescue Saul's body? It was men from that town. They never forgot how brave Saul was and how good it was for Saul to come to their defense, even though they were way out in the middle of nowhere. So Saul really, he got off to a good start. It's not all bad news when you look at his life. But clearly, if you want to start by looking at Saul's downfall, it starts with disobedience. And here's what Saul does. God gives him very explicit directions as to how to handle himself and how to rule as the king. And you see right away in 1 Samuel chapter 13, right away, Saul gets off to a poor start. And here's the thing, it's kind of subtle. What Saul does is he gets instructions from God, and they're very precise. And Saul does most of what God asks him to do, but not all that God asks him to do. And that will be a pattern that marks Saul's life. He will do what is expedient, what's easy for him to do, but when it starts to ruffle other people's feathers, because Saul was a people pleaser, and he didn't want other people to look down on him. So when he was faced with a decision between fully obeying God and ticking off some other people or losing the favor of other people, very oftentimes Saul chose to live as a people pleaser. He would do most of what he was asked to do, but not all that he was asked to do. The other thing you see in Saul's life very clearly is he did what was convenient for him to be able to hold on to his power and his prestige. And that dominated his choices. I think you can see in Saul's life, but I'll bet you can even recognize in your own life, and certainly we can see it in the lives of other people, that there's times where we read the Bible. We understand very clearly what it means to live a life connected to God, the way he desires for us to live, the way he made us to live. And you may be, there may come a conflict either with personal relationships, maybe it's with making a moral decision about your work or your workplace, and it may come in conflict with what are very clear instructions about what God asks you to do. I think there's no better test of our true loyalties to God than those moments when we decide, am I really willing, even though it's not popular, even though other people may be angry with me or look down on me, am I willing to fully embrace my commitment that I made to honor God with my life? I think there's no better place to check our loyalties. Saul chooses to live in what I call Burger King land. Now, if you go on to the web and you look at Burger King's website, the first thing that comes up next to the name Burger King is their slogan. Anybody know what it is? Ooh, some people here live in Burger King land, I can see. Yeah, you can have it your way. And so the picture there is what? You go to Burger King and what? You get to have it your way. And see, this is so much about what Saul is all about. Saul demands to have it his way. When it was convenient and easy for him to do what God wanted to do, no problem. He was willing to obey. But you know what? When push came to shove, Saul's ultimate decision maker was what? I want to do things my way that will increase my power, my prosperity, and make it so that I get what I want in life. And he wants to live in eternal Burger King land. And in doing that, you can see, now here's the thing that we're going to find out in a couple minutes. In doing that, in choosing to make his own agenda, his ultimate loyalty ultimately to his own personal pleasure and causes at the expense of doing what God does, you'll find out that Saul not only hurts himself, but you'll see that Saul also hurts lots of other people by serving himself and his own self-interest. The other thing that Saul does that quickly leads to his demise, that really makes his story tragic, is that he distances himself from the key people that God put in his life. Now, when you think about the assets that you have in your own life that make it so that you can get through difficult times or what will help you prosper in your own life, I bet you won't have to look very far before you recognize that in your own life, some of the best assets at your own disposal are other people that God has brought into your life. And that is so true of Saul. Do you recognize how blessed, I mean, we use that word a lot, but do you recognize how good God was to this guy? Think about who he put in his life. Samuel. Samuel was the guy who had the inside track of understanding what it meant to hear God's voice and obey it. And Samuel could be Saul's right-hand man in life. He brings in and makes it clear to Saul very early on who's going to be the next ruler of the kingdom. And Saul has the opportunity. Saul could have been an amazing mentor, helping David learn to be the very best king for the people of Israel that they could have had. And he also could have recognized that David was a pretty sharp guy. And even though he was younger than him, he could have recognized, I have a lot to gain by learning from David also. He also has this son who is phenomenal. He supports his dad. He lays his life on the line for his dad. He's one of the most valiant leaders and military men that Saul will ever have in his reign. The kid was amazing. And his son also loved him enough to tell him the truth when his dad needed to hear it, and never in a disrespectful way. He was outstanding. What does Saul do with those great assets that God gives him? He throws them away systematically, isolating himself from those best resources God gave him. It's so tragic when you read this passage in Samuel chapter 15, because what it says is after a disagreement that Saul has with Samuel, it says, Samuel went to his home, Saul went to his home, and Samuel would never see Saul alive again till his death. Man, what a tragic story. See, here's the thing. I really believe that it's not a question of if, but it's really just sort of a matter of time in everybody's life before we need other people to help us through the challenges and the trials of life. And I promise you that whatever assets God gives you to get through difficult times, the best resource you can have is other people that love you and love God and want what's best for your life. Here's the thing, though. It takes effort, energy, and it takes special attention to recognize who those people are. And it takes a commitment of time to be able to cultivate those relationships so that when it does hit the fan, because it will, that you have a network of people that really love you, really want what's best for you, and are really able to speak into your life from a place where you need to hear from God. So important. And so many of us do what Saul did, though. And what we do is we pick friends and we pick our associates according to who likes to fish with me, who likes to hunt with me, who likes to play basketball with me, who likes to sew with me or go to the ballet or the theater or whatever. And those become our most important associates and networks. And it's not that they're not fun people, nice to hang out with, that we don't get along with, but those are not always the people that are the people that we really need to have in our life. You'll hear lots of things this morning from me, but I think for some of you, that might be the most important thing you're going to hear today, is to learn to cultivate those kind of relationships. If you're a man and you know you need another strong man in your life that will help you understand and know what it means to follow God the way he wants you to as a father or a husband, don't just wait. God may bring that person to you, but don't just wait. Go out and find someone and say, I need someone like you in my life. If you don't have it, seek it out. Make it a priority. It's one of the things that of all the outstanding people that I know that are people that do remain faithful and do make up through those hard times are people that have cultivated a rich network of other people that they can lean on through difficult times. And Saul does everything he can because these people served God and his interests, and Saul was just more interested in serving his own. So he alienated himself from these other people. The next thing that Saul does is he gets distracted, and it's very, very costly. Okay, so to illustrate this, some of you are going to go, what the heck is a map going to do to help me understand this? But please follow along here. This is very, very important to really understand what happens in Saul's life that's so tragic here. Okay, so you get the map. The green pinpoint is where Jerusalem is, and that's where Jerusalem is today, and that's where Jerusalem would be when David takes over as king. Now, Saul meets his death up high, up near the northern border, very fertile land up on Mount Gilboa. It's part of a long mountain range up there. Now, if you are north of Mount Gilboa, looking south, this is what you'd see. It's not a huge mountain. It's only up about 1,500 feet, and this mountain range extends all the way out to the ocean, kind of this nice, cool border that was a great strategic place to hold because there was a big valley on one side and a big valley on the other. So whoever was in power really wanted to hold on to this place. And you can see from that picture, and then this is a panorama. If you were on top of Mount Gilboa, and you can't help but notice, man, that is good farmland. And you know what? This is a modern-day picture, but it was good farmland back then. And because they didn't have reservoirs and stuff like that, they needed the best farmland. Everybody wanted the best farmland. So every one of Israel's neighbors was always attacking, trying to get this area of land because it was so fertile and would provide for so many people. People really, really wanted it. So Saul is up on top of this mountain of this beautiful place over this lookout, and it's where he meets his ultimate demise. Now, the Philistines, if you look on almost any map, the Philistines, follow with me, don't get lost. This is important. This is the distraction. I don't want to distract you with the map. So this map shows us where the main area of the Philistines was. And they were almost always relegated to this very small territory down to the south of what we call Israel today. And that was their borders. They had three major cities, and most of their time they were relegated or kept right there. In fact, the area really shrunk under David and then Solomon. Now, It's interesting because when you read this story and you look at this map, you go, well, it's interesting because here's the valley where David fought Goliath. It's almost where all the major battles took place between Israel and the Philistines. So you kind of have to wonder, if you follow this stuff, why in the world does Saul die way the heck up there? This is so far away from the main area that the Philistines had always occupied and that the Israelites had always kept them to. So why does Saul die way up there? Well, here's the thing. Saul, who was called by God to protect, provide, and look out for the people of the nation of Israel, and one of the main responsibilities he has as king was to subdue the enemy, which at this time the main enemy was the Philistines. Now, Saul doesn't do this very well. And why doesn't he attend to one of these main... This is one of his main functions as king. Why doesn't he attend to taking the Philistines and keeping them down there? Anybody know? What's he doing? Where is he and his army during so much of his reign? Saul is chasing David. He's doing everything in his power to deny David, who's going to be the next ruler of Israel, the opportunity to do that. He's so desperate to hold on to his own power that rather than paying attention to the big picture, the main job that God gave him, he's so distracted, so preoccupied with what he thinks is most important that he totally relegates one of his main responsibilities. And the Philistines expand, 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 and expand their territory. And see, it's not only costly because Saul dies, but do you remember what it said to all of the people that lived in this valley of Jezreel and all the way out to the west of the Jordan? What happened to them? They all got displaced. The people that Saul was supposed to look after, protect, provide peace for, because of his selfish ambitions, he costs all of those people their lives, their livelihoods, their homes. They're all displaced because of his own personal passions in life. But that wouldn't happen to any of you in here, would it? You'd never get distracted from the main thing God wants you to do in life or his main priorities. A couple months ago, we were sitting down looking at the outline of the calendar of when we're going to preach and stuff like that. And so one of the things I saw on the calendar is my wife was due on the 18th. So I thought, probably be smart if I don't preach the week before or the week after my wife is due, right? That'd probably be smart. So we planned it like that, and it worked out great. And then a couple weeks ago, something came up, and Dan said, hey, he texts me and says, hey, can we swap this Sunday? And I thought, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. And it wasn't until about a week and a half later that I looked and go, oh, it's a week before Heather's due. But you know what? No problem. My wife, she's had four kids, never been early with a delivery. So no problem. Nothing's going to happen this time. So the week leading up to this last Sunday, I was working, studying. My wife was fine, no problem. And I got to tell you, I was really excited about the passage and the message. I mean, it's the kind of message that when you're a teacher, you read and you go, oh man, this is good stuff. I can't wait to do this. I was getting really excited. You know, there's kind of this tension between nerves and excitement. And this is one of those Sundays where my excitement far outweighed my nerves. I was stoked to do this message. Friday, I'm sitting in my office working on my notes, and Heather calls me from the beach and she says, you know what, I'm having kind of strong contractions. And I told her, hey, just relax. We've got to get through Sunday here. Saturday morning rolls around, and I had already told Dan at staff meeting Tuesday, hey, you know what? I don't think it's going to be a problem. My wife never delivers early. Don't worry about it. But if something does happen, will you be ready? And Dan rolls his eyes and goes, why didn't you tell me this sooner? And so I call Dan Saturday morning. My wife wakes up, and she goes, I'm having pretty strong regular contractions. And I told her, just relax and keep your legs crossed. You'll be just fine. I got to teach on Sunday. And I said to her, I said, what do you want to do? And she said, I think it'd just be good to go to the hospital and check things out. Okay. So I called Dan and I said, hey, it looks like I'm going to be ready tomorrow, but just in case. And Dan grumbles, thanks for ruining my Saturday, kid. And Dan got ready to preach. We go to the hospital. We get there at 10:30, and one of the things that I bring to the hospital besides my bag of clothes is I brought my computer because I had not finished all of my slides yet for Sunday. So my wife is in the bed, and I'm sitting on the couch, And she's having contractions, and I'm looking at her, talking to her, making sure she's good, comfortable, getting her drinks and stuff like that. But I am working furiously on my laptop, finishing up my slides. Is my wife in here to throw anything at me? I don't see her back here. That's good. I'd be in big trouble. I don't want her to relive this moment. So I'm sitting there madly trying to finish my slides because I'm stoked about preaching on Saturday. And here's what my hope is. My hope is, you know what? She'll have the baby in the afternoon. I'll come preach on Sunday and go home. Some of you are shaking your heads. I don't know why. 2 o'clock, I finally realized how asinine I was being. And I closed my computer and I put it away. And I'm like, what in the world am I doing? This is one of the greatest days God has given us as a family. And I'm thinking about Sunday. And you know what? Here's the deal. Check this out. Who wouldn't say, though, just in my own defense, who wouldn't say that as a pastor, preaching is an important job, something you ought to take seriously and regard highly, you know, and you guys have high expectations for us. We have high expectations to do well on Sunday. And I like my job, and I feel like it's important. It's something that God's called me to do well, right? What could be more important than being a good pastor? I didn't need you to answer that. So, you know, I woke up and I smelled the coffee and I go, this is just ridiculous. So I put my computer away at 2 o'clock and fully focused on what was most important at the moment. Do you think it's plausible, though, that someone might work on moments like that? When even though they have an important family responsibility, they feel called, motivated, they desire to do a good job with their profession. And there might be moments in their life where they because they have a desire to do well at their job or their commitment to their profession, that sometimes there's this balancing act, and maybe occasionally they would put their profession, their job at a higher level than maybe another responsibility. And do you think that might continue on for a while in life? And do you think it's plausible that might continue on long enough that kids grow up in a home and graduate out of the home and look back and have frank conversations with mom or dad and said, hey, I know you loved us, but honestly, we know you loved your work more. Or for a wife to even say, let's say my wife, to even say, I know you loved us and I know you loved the kids, but you love the church and your job more. You think do you think that's remotely possible that something like that might happen? No. Because you probably know people that have lived through that. You might have lived through that. And I can tell you I've met other pastors that have lived through that. And that is one of my greatest fears in life, is that I'll get out of balance and I'll justify it because I feel like being a pastor is a high calling. And I will not take my higher responsibility, which is being a good husband and a good dad, as my primary responsibility. Because I don't want to stand before God and have him say, Noah, you are a great pastor. You sure serve those people well. But gosh, sure would have been nice if you were as dedicated to the family I gave you as you were to your church. But I'll tell you what, this last Saturday was a good reminder of just how easy it is to get distracted, even by something that really is a pretty good thing to be committed to. And see, so when we read about Saul's life and we go, gosh, what a cheese ball. This guy was so worried about his own power, keeping his own line of authority going, that he was distracted from these good things that God was doing. You know what? I think we all know that it's really not that hard to fall into that trap that Saul fell into. Now, all of this stuff is really interesting, and it's capped off by a moment of pure desperation on his part. And you can see that in Saul's life. He's made one bad decision after another bad decision after another one. And he gets to the end of the line here, and he's trying to decide what to do about this fight with the Philistines, and he's not hearing from God. Well, no wonder he's not hearing from God. He's alienated all the people that were helping him hear and learn and know God in his life. And here's the thing. One of the things that Saul does well at the beginning is he rids the land of all of the soothsayers, the prophecy people that came and, you know, had direct lines you know, to God and to other powers too. He gets rid of all of the, you know, you might call them the tarot card readers of today. He gets rid of all of the psychics out of the land. That was a good thing. Now, in his moment of desperation, because he can't hear from God, and he's desperate to figure out what to do, he says, you know what? Find me someone who can give me some advice. They send him to a witch who lives in Endor, and the witch, guess who the witch brings up for him to hear from? It was Samuel. And he knows he's toast the minute he recognizes it's Samuel, and he's freaked out. He gets to hear, but it was not what he wanted to hear at all. But you see, this moment of desperation is something that so many of us know, that, you know, poor choices after poor choices can lead us to a dismal place of despair in our lives. And sometimes that place of despair can be so bad that we can't think or function any other way than to think, I'll just keep going. And inevitably, keep going just leads to more, and sometimes worse, moral compromise. There's a great saying that I think is pretty easy to understand. When you're in a hole, you know what? It's okay to stop digging. It's so hard to do sometimes. And this is the whole reason why it's important to have good friends around you that will yell in the hole, stop digging! But man, it's so important. I'll come back to this in just a couple of minutes here as we wrap up. That it is okay to stop digging. And I'll tell you why, because there's a great hope that we have, and I'll talk about it in just a minute. This all leads to Saul's death. And it's really fascinating because I want to just talk real briefly about this. Some people wonder why in the Old Testament there's a book called 1 and 2 Kings that talks all about Israel's kings. And then there's also this other book called 1 and 2 Chronicles, and it also talks all about the kings of Israel. People go, well, like, why are they repeated? There's so much of the same material covered in here. Kings was written immediately after the people were led into exile. And it was written for a very specific reason, to tell the people, this is what led to your demise. And it was written in a way that if anybody who read it go, oh, gee, no wonder we're in this mess we're in, right? That's why 1 Kings was written. A good example of that, 1 Kings 11. It says, King Solomon, he was a great guy, right? He did all sorts of cool things. Oh, yeah, he also had 700 concubines, 300 wives. And you go, oh, so there were some other issues going on here, too. That's why 1 Kings was written. 1 and 2 Chronicles was written at the very end of the exile as the people were getting ready to come home. And it's written in a very different way. It's written to say, hey, you know what? We weren't perfect, but look at all the good things God did in and through us. And we still have a hope that we can do this right by being aligned with God the way he intended for us to rule this land. And that's why Chronicles was written. There are a couple of overlapping stories. One of them here is 1 Chronicles 10, which overlaps the story that you just read about Saul's demise. And in it, it's very explicit about why Saul dies. I want you to hear this. It says, so Saul died because he was unfaithful to the Lord. He failed to obey the Lord's command and even consulted a medium, which is the witch we just talked about, instead of asking the Lord for guidance. So the Lord killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, his son, the son of Jesse. Now, this is about the only incidents in the book of Chronicles that really works hard to portray any of the kings in this bad of a light. So why does it do this? Because it really wants us to understand what happened to Saul and why he died the way he did. The key word here is this word unfaithful. And if you have your Bibles, I want you to circle it in there. It's a lot of times, you know, we talk about sin, we think like sin is about disobeying a set of rules. So you might, well, let's just use the Ten Commandments as an example. You might think, well, the Ten Commandments tell me how to live. When I break one of those commandments, that means I sinned, right? And that is one way of really understanding what it means to be disobedient to God. He gives us those instructions to help us understand what it means to live connected to him. Here is another way to understand sin. And this is the primary way the Old Testament lays out what sin is all about. It's about a relationship. And it's about the choices that we make to estrange ourselves from other people and particularly from God. That's why it uses this relational word first, unfaithful. What's that a picture of? It's a picture of a covenant that two people make to be bound together, to trust, be committed, do nothing to violate one another, right? And that's the picture that God uses again and again and again in the Old Testament to help people understand when you make choices that violate our relational covenant, it brings about estrangement from us. So people wonder, why do I feel like I'm separated from God? It's because we were made for a relationship with Him. And when we make choices that alienate ourselves from Him and the way we were meant to live with Him, we feel that estrangement. And everybody understands that. If you're a husband or a wife and trust is broken, if you're a parent and your kids habitually break that trust, everybody knows what estrangement feels like. That's why the Old Testament uses this language and this illustration of what it means to be separated from God. And that is the problem here. And notice this. Someone might say, well, Saul, it sounds like God killed him. Wasn't God just a big puppet player? No, see, that's what this is all about. It's saying Saul had choices. He made decisions to be unfaithful. It was up to him. He chose this life. It was in his hands to do differently and to turn around. Here's the things two things I want you to think about as you walk away from here. And maybe when you go home tonight, you can sit at your dinner table and talk about this with your family, or during the week, take out these notes and go over them with your friends and get their input on it and see what they think about this stuff and discuss it together. But the first thing is, I think it's pretty easy to see that careless decisions, and sometimes they're very small decisions that we make that we don't think are that big of a deal, especially in terms of compromise, really can, over the long haul, turn into very costly deals. Who doesn't know that, like when you cut a corner on building a house or getting your car fixed, and sometimes you cut the corners by wanting to save money and get a cheaper part, and how many of you have ever experienced that burden of later on it costing way more to set it right because you didn't do it right the first time? See, we all understand how this principle works. And this is the thing about living an unexamined life. We cut corners, it might lead to cutting another corner. It might lead to cutting another corner. And before you know it, you've cut so many corners. Your life is such a wreck. You're so far away that you realize those little things really added up to put yourself in a difficult situation. It can be expensive, as Saul found out. And the further he got, you know what I'd say? It was probably very hard for him to stop digging because he had gone so far down. Here's the thing, though. It doesn't matter how far you've dug. It doesn't matter how far you are away. And I'm not going to say that the further you are away doesn't matter and it's easy to get back to a place where you're connected and committed to God. But see, here, if you want to understand an essential difference between Saul and David, is probably this. Dan did such a good job last week, if you didn't get to hear him, talking about how it's never too late to call on the mercy and grace of God. David, by no means, was a picture of someone who lived a perfect life, right? We can see so many issues that David had. Way before you even get to David and Bathsheba, you can see David making some poor decisions along the way. But the issue of David and Bathsheba illustrate this so well. It wasn't just the lust. It wasn't even just the committing of adultery. But David even killed. He was dishonest. He employed other people to help kill Bathsheba's husband, right? I mean, he gets so far away. But here's the difference. When he's confronted by Nathan, how does he respond? He doesn't go, oh, woe is me. He doesn't say, oh, woe is me. I'm too far down the road. All hope for me is lost. What does he do? He throws himself on the mercy and grace of God, which is good news for you and I and our friends and our family. That no matter how far down you dig, no matter how far off that road you get, no matter how many bad corners you cut, here, 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 and you go, gosh, it's hopeless. No. See, that's the great message of the Scripture, isn't it? That after 4,000 years, God made a promise. And after 4,000 years of humanity denying, rebelling, walking away from God, He's not done yet. And even knowing the bleak future, very oftentimes, of the people that would call themselves Christians, God still sent His only Son to die on the cross. So that estrangement that we feel, that brokenness we feel, that hopelessness that we get in our lives can be fixed. There is always hope, and that's the great message of the Bible. And even looking at someone's life as dismal as Saul reminds us that there is hope for the future. The nation had gone so far away from God's intention, so far away from what God intended for those people. And Saul is the capstone on that. And you think, how could they ever recover from this? And in that sense, God sort of sent them a Savior in David, didn't he? In that sense, God sort of sent us a Savior, Jesus. And you may find yourself just like Saul. You may find yourself in a situation where you feel like it's hopeless and you've gone too far. That's the great message and the great hope that we have. We can always turn and throw ourselves on the mercy of God. We can always repent from where we are and work back to finding that connection, to living the kind of life that God desired for us to live. That's our great hope today, and that's our great hope for our nation. It's our great hope for our friends. It's our great hope for ourselves. God bless you guys, and have a good week. If our ushers will come forward, we'll have our offering. Have a great week, guys.